Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On January 6th, 2021, one group stands out among the sea of people who attacked the United States Capitol. This group is wearing sophisticated tactical gear. Tan and camouflage jackets and pants, helmets, goggles, military vests, and other paraphernalia. They march in a disciplined column up the Capitol steps, each person holding on to the shoulder of the person in front of them. And they slice through the crowd, never breaking formation.
Took over the Capitol, overran the Capitol.
We're in the Capitol, bro.
They are members of the Oath Keepers, a far-right paramilitary group. And on January 13th of this year, 11 of the Oath Keepers were indicted in federal court for seditious conspiracy. It's the first such major charge in the Justice Department's massive criminal investigation into the Capitol attack. So today we're going to try to understand more about the Oath Keepers and of the seditious conspiracy charge. And to help us do that, Ryan Riley joins us, reporter with HuffPost, who will be moving to NBC News next month. Ryan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more of what the Oath Keepers did on January 6th.
The Oath Keepers essentially all gathered together at the Capitol and formed this sort of stack. There's two major components to this. There's the stack at the Capitol, and then there's actually these so-called quick reaction forces outside of D.C. in suburban Virginia in Arlington at a hotel there, where people had weapons that were sort of ready to go at the word of the head of the Oath Keepers, who Stuart Rhodes, the prosecutors say, could have given the word for a lot of these people who are outside of D.C. to then come into the Capitol.
So that stack that you, that phrase you use, that's that column that I was talking about, that that image should show them marching up the east steps of the Capitol, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. They were in that formation, sort of had their hands on one another's backs as they sort of moved through this mob and made their way. It's a military stack formation is really what that reference is to. So they used a lot of these military terms in the course of this alleged plot. You know, they're talking about quick reaction forces, which is another military form. Stack is another military term. So a lot of this is sort of rooted in, military language.
Mm. So quick reaction force, or QRF. You know, you said that the indictment also contains allegations that about the they had weapons ready to go. Can you tell us more? Do we know what kinds of weapons and specifically where?
Yeah, so there's a lot of weapons. There are apparently three different groups from parts of the country where three different QRF reaction forces were based mostly off of this hotel in Arlington, where some of the participants were staying. Some of them actually, they have photos of them from surveillance cameras at the hotel wheeling packages, wheeling things into the room. Some of the guns were kept outside in the back of one of the trucks, allegedly. So the idea was that from there, if called up, this quick reaction force would have been able to come into the Capitol. And it's sort of a little bit not clear right now what exactly happened with them. There was apparently never this order given for them to come in, even though one of the alleged participants was sort of asking, you know, can we come in now? But it's unclear exactly some of what happened sort of after the Capitol was already breached. Prosecutors noted in one filing that they weren't necessary, this quick reaction force, because the participants at the stack were able to breach the Capitol on their own.
Okay. And does the indictment contain any allegations of what the Oath Keepers are said to have intended to do once they entered the Capitol?
It doesn't get into a ton of specifics there. That's sort of left a little bit open-ended. There had been some discussion about essentially the Oath Keepers thought of themselves as this sort of supplementary force. And there was talk about President Trump invoking the Insurrection Act and then them sort of standing up and being this military that would be able to come into place when called upon, when needed. That's what they thought that they were doing, essentially backing up Trump and doing what the president was calling them. They thought the president was calling them to do. And it's understandable because, you know, we've had instances of the president during the 2020 campaign giving sort of aid to the group. With a proud voice, he sort of told them to stand back and stand by. So it's not unreasonable necessarily that you would think that the former president was in your lane and was sort of counting on your support.
Okay, so Ryan, stand by here for just a second because we want to learn a little bit more about the background on the Oath Keepers. So to do that, I want to turn to Rachel Carol Rivas. She joins us from Helena, Montana. She's senior research analyst leading the anti-government research team and the intelligence project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Rachel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about the founder of the Oath Keepers. Ryan mentioned his name, Stuart Rhodes.
Yeah, so Stuart Rhodes did indeed found Oath Keepers in 2009. He was also in the military, in the Army, like some of the Oath Keepers. He also has a law degree. He went to Yale and graduated in 2004, did relatively well. He went on to clerk for Arizona Supreme Court Justice, Michael Ryan. And politically, Rhodes identifies as a libertarian. He particularly worked for Congressman Ron Paul for a short time and volunteered on his presidential campaign run. After that, when Rhodes founded Oath Keepers, that's really when things turned for him and, quite frankly, turned for our country to end up where we are today. He has been married, has kids, but really is estranged from his family and isolated his family, including through homeschooling. His family claims that he's actually a fraud and a narcissist. But he associated with a whole slew of folks across the anti-government spectrum for years, including frequent appearances on Alex Jones.
Oh, okay. So what is it that Rhodes has said that the purpose or intention of the Oath Keepers is?
Yeah, so for Rhodes, I think, you know, it's really rooted in this conspiratorial thinking about the federal government and the government in general. You know, that is the root of Oath Keepers, as well as really all of the anti-government and militia organizations across the country. They have long talked, specifically Rhodes, about the upcoming second civil war, and about this opportunity to really lean into the militia. Rhodes was always actually questioning any overthrowing of the government by the military. That was very counter to the beliefs of Oath Keepers, but leaned really specifically into the idea that the militia would be the sort of saviors of liberty. And they inserted themselves in a variety of standoffs with government and activist events for, you know, all the years that the organization has existed. In some ways, it felt like, for those of us watching Oath Keepers all this time, that it was a slow build up to January 6th, something that we hope we had could have prevented, but in some ways was sort of everything about where they were headed.
So as you heard Ryan talk about, I mean, there's not only just military language that the Oath Keepers are said to have used on January 6th, but in fact, what looks like military training. So how... are there ties that members of the Oath Keepers have to military or law enforcement?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the key, you know, facets of Oath Keepers for Rhodes, was to target law enforcement, former military, current law enforcement and military, as well as first responders. this is, you know, unique in the sense that it was fairly successful, but not unique in the anti-government movement. It's, you know, been pushed by a variety of activists from John Lamb and others in previous decades. But, you know, of the thousands of members that Oath Keepers likely had, and a very large network, somewhere in the range of, you know, 30,000 folks in their network, there are at least, you know, hundreds of people that we can document that have been, are currently or were currently at the time of their membership in law enforcement and military. It's hard to judge how many folks are veterans, but from the chats and a lot of leaked documents, you know, indications are that, you know, they were heavily, you know, included membership with military experience.
Now, how does the membership of the Oath Keeper in terms of size, the Oath Keepers in terms of size, compare to other paramilitary organizations that SPLC keeps a track of, Rachel?
Yeah, so, you know, so many of the militia organizing that's gone on in the U.S. has been really about geographically located, small, local-focused issues. So really quite tiny in the fact that each organization, collectively, they've made up a, you know, a movement that is concerning. But Oath Keepers is different in the sense that it was centrally located, national organization with national reach, that had chapters in localities and states around the country, as well as engaged in issues both at that local level and at the national level, you know, from elections issues in 2017 to elections activities as security in 2020. They, you know, they really had a huge reach. I think probably still the largest of any anti-government group in the country, but questionable about how long that lasts.
We have a minute to go here, Rachel, so I'll at least let you start the answer to this question. Do we know if the Oath Keepers have any ties to Donald Trump or Donald Trump's current or former advisors or people who were in his orbit?
That's really interesting. We know that Oath Keepers has long targeted working with politicians and had a number of events where members of Congress stood up on the stage with Oath Keepers. How clearly that was tied into the administration, I think, is more questionable. And part of that, it's because how do you fight against the federal government while both tying yourself to a federal government of Donald Trump at the same time? That's a conundrum.
Well, Rachel Carroll Rivas, Senior Research Analyst leading the anti-government research team at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thank you, Rachel, so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Riley, stand by for a little bit. We'll talk more about the Oath Keepers and dig deep into what seditious conspiracy means when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the charge of seditious conspiracy leveled against many members of the Oath Keepers far-right militia group. Those charges leveled by the Department of Justice earlier this month. I'm joined today by Ryan Riley. He's currently with HuffPost, soon to go to NBC News. And we're going to dig into the details of what seditious conspiracy means in just a second here, Ryan. But I wanted to ask you what answer you might have to that question I asked Rachel before the break about, do we know if there are any known ties between members of the Oath Keepers and those people in Donald Trump's orbit? Because I'm recalling here that there was reporting that on January 5th and 6th, at least two or three members of the Oath Keeper were seen surrounding Roger Stone as security. And those same members are amongst those who've been charged with seditious conspiracy. Do you have any more information about that?
Yeah, that seems to be the most clear connection at this point, I think, that we know about in terms of direct communications between people in Trump's orbit and people in the Oath Keepers. But, you know, the Oath Keepers have been in these circles for a very long time. I remember speaking to Stuart Rhodes, you know, over a decade ago when he was at a conservative, CPAC, he was at a conservative conference. So it's not as though they're completely out of this realm. They have a lot of connections, even as their rhetoric has sort of been more extreme. There's definitely some affiliations and some alignments. We just don't know about those direct lines of communication so far.
So tell me more then, since you have spoken directly with Rhodes, even though it was many years ago, tell me more about, you know, what you know about him that can help us understand what happened on January 6th and then the charges as well.
Yeah, it is this interesting. He's an interesting character because you look at his background, as was mentioned before, you know, this Yale education, this high education, and then sort of but you look at the group that he sort of has built that has a lot of these extremist elements in it, and he's sort of the ringleader there. There have been some allegations about how he spent money. The Wall Street Journal has done some reports on how he's actually spending some of his members' dues. And, you know, there's also been these massive security breaches of the organization now that we've seen a lot of sort of hacks of their data come out that have revealed a lot of members who are affiliated with the Oath Keepers here, their emails, their names. It's blown up in a lot of people's faces who were members of law enforcement or had jobs that were that they didn't believe these affiliations would be coming out and have caused a lot of trouble in their lives.
Mm, okay. Well, and now that trouble also includes charges of seditious conspiracy levied upon them by the United States government. So, Ryan, hang on here for a second. I want to bring Jenny Carroll into the conversation. She's a professor of law at the University of Alabama School of Law and joins us from Birmingham. Professor Carroll, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, first of all, here it is. I'm going to read it straight out of the U.S. Code, 18 U.S. Code, subsection 2384, seditious conspiracy. If two or more persons in any state or territory or any place subject to the jurisdiction of the United States conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or oppose by force the authority thereof, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, and on it goes. So how appropriate do you think the seditious conspiracy charge is for what the government alleges the Oath Keepers did on the 6th of January?
Yeah, and that's a hard question. I mean, it's the charge that you just read from the U.S. Code contains elements like any other criminal charge. And in order to bring a case against anyone under that section of the code, you would have to have sufficient evidence to support those elements. Now, the proof required for a charge versus a conviction is certainly less. You only need probable cause to charge. But based on what your other guests have said and what the U.S. Attorney's Office has released, the suggestion is that these individuals did agree, they came together, they agreed that they were going to try to, by force, prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of the laws of the United States, namely the certification of the election, which allowed for the appointment of electors to name Joe Biden president. So based on that, certainly they appear to meet the elements. Now, obviously, the case hasn't gone to trial yet, so we don't know what their defense will be. But if you're asking me, do I think there's a colorable case? I think the answer is yes.
Colorable meaning in non-legal language?
Colorable meaning, I think it's not outside the realm for them to bring this charge. And okay. And again, we can talk about this more, but sedition is a relatively rare charge. It's not one of the more common criminal charges one would expect to see, even within a federal court. But And I think part of the reason it is so rare is it does have those elements that you have to come together. It can't be just one person. It's got to be two or more people. They have to conspire, which means in non-legal terms, they have to come to agreement on a common purpose, and they have to take some actions to try to achieve that common purpose. But in this case, as your earlier guest described, you have a group of folks who appear to be very well organized. They do march in that stack formation up the steps of the Capitol. They're not part of a random mob. There's been some planning that's happened beforehand. We know from the documents released by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And again, this is a well-established, well-organized group that acted with a particular purpose. So based on all of that, it's not surprising that the U.S. Attorney's Office would conclude that they can actually bring a charge of sedition against these individuals.
Okay. So I want to just play a little bit of tape here from Michael Sherwin, who served as the acting U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia in 2020 and 2021, and he supervised the early months of the January 6th investigation. And he's going to repeat a little bit of what you said here, because we just talked to him yesterday. But here's why he said that the sedition charges against the Oath Keepers are notable.
When you look at sedition, there's essentially three prongs of the Federal Sedition Act. One is to conspiracy to forcibly overthrow the government. The second bucket, as you will, is to hinder, delay, or deny the execution of U.S. laws. And then the third category of sedition is to forcibly seize U.S. property. And I think what's interesting here is when you look at what was charged in January 6th, with sedition, it's really in that second category, and that's different than what we've seen historically from the department. It's hindering or obstructing the execution of U.S. laws. We're here. That law, that execution was the certification of the election, and this is very different from the other sedition cases in which it was really the first category, the overthrow of the United States government. Mm.
Now, Professor Carroll, the reason why I wanted to sort of emphasize that point is I think a lot of people previously had thought that sedition and insurrection were kind of interchangeable, right? And they were focused on the overthrow part. But as both you and Michael Sherwin there are saying, the delay or hindering of the execution of the U.S. law here is really the pivot point. I mean, look, from the outside, from a non-legal perspective, just as from a citizen perspective, I see all of those things. I mean, they went in, they seized property, they seized the Capitol. They absolutely succeeded in the delay of the electoral count. So, but yet, and at the same time, you earlier said that it's a little bit complicated. What are the complexities specifically regarding the sedition charge against the Oath Keepers?
Well, so, I mean, first of all, I should offer the caveat that I am not in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mm. So they're making charging decisions. I'm looking at them from the outside, yeah, as are you. So this is what I would say. It's complicated in the sense of if we go under that first prong or that first bucket of elements, as your previous guest described, we would have to show that they were in agreement that their goal was to overthrow the U.S. government. And that's a little complicated because, as other speakers have already noted, there's some questions about whether or not they were working with the executive branch or those associated with the executive branch. So maybe not formal government actors like Roger Stone, but people certainly associated with that executive branch. And if they're doing that in a way that's designed to support that executive branch, you might raise a question of, are they really trying to overthrow the U.S. government, or are they merely trying to disrupt one portion of the government, the legislative branch that is trying to certify these electors? So in that sense, it makes sense that they would go under that second prong. Now, the other thing that makes it complicated, and we've seen this in past sedition charges, particularly in past sedition charges that have been brought against groups that are associated with the right or white supremacists or self-identify as Christian religious groups, there's been an issue about whether or not they actually had a common agreement or a common plan to overthrow the government. So if you're asking a fact finder, either a jury or a judge, to make a decision about whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support that element, that they actually are conspiring to overthrow the government, you're going to have to show that common plan. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office may have just thought, gosh, that is a high bar to meet. it is far easier to demonstrate exactly what we all observed on television as we watched January 6th unfold in our homes, which was they blocked the certification of the electoral vote. And in doing that, they hindered, delayed, or prevented the execution of the laws of the United States. So it's a lower or easier prong for them to meet, not because it's any less threatening. And I don't mean to suggest that, or any less dangerous or any less concerning to us as people who live in the United States, but because that's what the evidence actually supports.
Yeah. Ryan Riley, let me turn back to you here, because if I understand correctly, a sort of key moment that led to the charges being unveiled earlier this month was that one of the Oath Keepers actually signed a plea deal. Is that right?
Yeah, a few months back, we had an Oath Keeper sign a plea deal. So that's definitely a major component of this. We've seen a lot of what's interesting, you know, in terms of the discovery is that a lot of these chats happened over Signal and the encrypted application. So in order to get those records, you really actually need to go directly to somebody who got them. You can't get them through an intermediate. You have to get them through someone who is directly involved in those communications. Like Signal literally has no ability to access the contents of communications. So it basically means that you have to get one of the end users to actually give away the material, whether that means by seizing their phone or whether that means by some sort of cooperation deal. They had those records, you know, earlier, and they've seized a number of phones along the way. But that's sort of given us an indication of how this investigation has unfolded. If they had not used encrypted applications, we might have not realized how in-depth this investigation was for a while, because they would have had those records without letting anyone know they did.
So because to prove the conspiracy, they needed to have that evidence, or at least to charge with the conspiracy part, they needed to have that evidence. Interesting. You know, and I'm seeing, for example, The Washington Post is reporting that in other court filings, the government alleges that one of the Oath Keepers, Jessica Watkins, during the attack on Congress on the 6th of January, is said to have told other Oath Keepers, "We have about 30 to 40 of us. We're sticking together and sticking to the plan. You are executing citizens' arrest." Basically saying that they have probable cause for lawmakers to arrest lawmakers for acts of treason and election fraud, according to audio recordings of communications between Oath Keepers on January 6th. Now, Professor Carroll, you talked about the history of when, or the rare times, the charge has actually been filed here. And Michael Sherwin, the former U.S. acting attorney in D.C., mentioned those as well. And here's what he said.
In the 80s, in 1988, there was the famous DOJ case in which a group of white supremacists were charged with sedition. It was the Fort Smith case out of Arkansas, federally charged. And those individuals walked. There was a full acquittal because that was a situation in which they were charged with sedition, overthrow of the United States government, a plot to also kill law enforcement officers, but a lot of that was aspirational. There were no actual acts that were put into play, and First Amendment concerns and issues played into that case.
Professor Carroll, respond to that.
Yeah, so he's absolutely right. And we could add to that 1988 case, we could add a 2010 case that involved a Christian militia group that had the same result. It did not result in a conviction on sedition. And I think that this really highlights how difficult it is to prove the elements, particularly when you are talking about that first bucket of elements concerning the overthrow of the government. You have to show that this is more than just you and I sitting around and talking about how frustrated we are with our government, or perhaps aspiring to overthrow that government. Not that we are, but if we were, right, under the First Amendment, we have the right to do that as people who live in the United States. Crossing that line, however, between aspiring to overthrow the government into actually taking some action and having some plan that results in an attempt to, or heaven forbid, the actual overthrow of the government, is what crosses that line from those protected First Amendment rights, which are about thought and speech and dissent and the ability to even petition our government for change, into that criminal area of sedition. And again, if we go up a step, even on to treason.
So, yeah, but Professor Carroll, can I just jump in here a second? Because you've kept saying the phrase overthrow the government. But mm-hmm. I thought that maybe I misheard you a little earlier, but I thought that the the seditious conspiracy charge that I read out of the U.S. code is it contains the word or, not overthrow the government and prevent, hinder, or delay execution of any law. It's or. So why do we keep saying overthrow the government when I thought what the DOJ in this case might have to prove is simply the prevent, hinder, or delay execution of any law of the United States?
Well, let me be clear. When I was speaking about overthrowing the government a minute ago, I was speaking of the 1988 case and the 2000.
Okay.
Both of which were charged under that first prong. But you are absolutely correct. It's actually that third prong, right, that deals with by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law. So this particular charge deals with a different prong, but we're still going to have to demonstrate the conspiracy. So the disjunctive you're describing, all those ors, that's what the conspiracy is for, right? So what are we conspiring to do? Are we conspiring to overthrow the government? Are we conspiring to levy war or oppose by force? Are we conspiring by force to prevent, hinder, or delay? It's that third one that they are charged under, but we're still going to have to show that they got together, they did more than just talk about it, they did more than just aspire to do it, that they actually had some plan in place that they all agreed upon, and that they acted in some way on that plan. They don't have to complete the plan, but they have to act in some way on that plan.
Okay, I very much appreciate the clarification because I really want everyone to understand this well. We're trying to battle back against misinterpretations of the law here. We've got about
a very important distinction.
Yeah, we have about 30 seconds left, Professor Carroll. What kind of defense might counsel for the Oath Keepers mount against these charges?
Well, so a couple of different defenses. One defense is always you can't believe the person who's flipped on us, right? They are lying in order to gain benefit from the government. That's one. And we've seen that used both in the 1988 case and in the 2010 case. Another defense that I think we can expect them to use is what you've already described. We were acting as responsible citizens. We're doing what we are entitled to do as citizens. This is not sedition.
Well, Jenny Carroll is a professor of law at the University of Alabama Law School, joining us today from Birmingham. Professor Carroll, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Ryan Riley, hang in there with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about exactly how all the information was gathered that led to the seditious conspiracy charges. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a heads up as to what's coming later this week. Last year, the gray wolf was removed from the endangered species list, and that allowed wolf hunting in many American states, Idaho, Montana, and Wisconsin. And so we're going to take a look at that because wolf hunts have taken place. We'll be talking to hunters, and we'll be also talking to members of indigenous tribes who are leading a legal battle to bring the wolf hunt to a stop. So we want to hear from you. Do you have any connections with the gray wolf? Are you part of a tribe or an indigenous group who wants the hunts to be stopped? What do you think about the fact that the wolf was removed from the endangered species list? Tell us your stories and your thoughts. 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for a show coming up a little later this week. Today, we are talking about the Oath Keepers and the fact that many members of the far-right paramilitary group were charged by the Justice Department earlier this month with seditious conspiracy in connection to their activities on January 6th of 2021, the attack on the Capitol. Ryan Riley joins us today. He's reporter with HuffPost, soon to be an with NBC News next month. And Ryan, I was just during the break, I was digging back into some of the court filings around the Oath Keepers. And just to give folks a little bit more detail, for example, regarding Edward Vallejo, one of the Oath Keepers who was indicted alongside Stuart Rhodes, the founder there. The government says that Vallejo was one of the folks who was in that quick reaction force, as you told us, Ryan, gathering the weapons and waiting to be called into the Capitol. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, he was based in Virginia. And one thing that was really interesting about his case is just before he was arrested by the FBI, he posted a tweet saying that he was going to go in and question the FBI about January 6th. And that didn't really work out too well for him. As it turned out, he was arrested when he went in for that interview.
Wow. Well, the government says in the court filing I'm looking at that Vallejo's conspirators did not activate him on January 6th, but that does not mitigate his dangerousness. He traveled across the country, staged himself near the congressional proceedings, ready to transport firearms and equipment into the nation's capital. And they also say there's no evidence that he has renounced violence or that he no longer believes in the necessity of guerrilla warfare after the 6th of January. So Ryan, the fact that the seditious conspiracy charge has finally come, I mean, a lot of observers were wondering if and when it would. Where does it tell you that the DOJ's overall criminal investigations are going?
Yeah, well, as your last guest sort of said, I think a lot of this goes back to the Huttery militia case back in 2010 and sort of the struggles that the Justice Department had in that case and the failures they had in that case. I think that's sort of what was underlying a lot of this lengthier legal analysis before the DOJ got to this point of bringing seditious conspiracy charges because of the failures there. In that case, it was a much different set of circumstances because you essentially had an FBI sting operation. Actually, I believe one FBI informant or even maybe an undercover officer was actually the best man in a wedding of one of the Huttery militia members. And that was a case that just failed at trial. And one of the issues there was that, like, you know, we discussed earlier, the First Amendment is a major hurdle here, and it's really tough to figure out how to roll out that FBI probe where it doesn't get to the point where it's actually dangerous, but you get to the point where it's a seditious conspiracy. And because the FBI was sort of involved in that case, they obviously couldn't let it get out of hand and let something actually happen, or that would be a huge, you know, scandal. But they had to bring the case to fruition at a point where they thought they had enough. And clearly in that case, they didn't have enough because of the results we saw at trial. So I think that Huttery militia case, as well as the general rareness of the use of the statute, is certainly what was going into the Justice Department's analysis here. They had to make sure that they had a really solid case to bring forward because this is such a rarely used statute.
Okay. Well, Ryan, listen along with me for a couple of minutes here, because, of course, one of the major differences between then and now is technology and social media and how much of what happened on January 6th was freely and openly documented by the very people who stormed the Capitol. So that gave rise almost immediately to a group of folks around the world on the internet who call themselves the Sedition Hunters. And they're citizens who and people who crawled the internet to look for evidence, and they helped the FBI and DOJ identify the alleged conspirators. So we spoke to John Scott Railton, senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, where he investigates malware, phishing, and disinformation. And even though he lives in Toronto, he is an American citizen. And he told us that on January 6th, 2021, he watched what happened at the Capitol.
There was one picture that really caught my attention. He was leaping over some seats in a divider in the Senate Visitors Gallery, and he was tacked out wearing black clothing, had his face masked up, had a hat, and had this clutch of temporary restraints in his hand, which zip ties. And I just saw that. I thought, God, what is going on here?
So he needed to figure out, who is this guy?
So for me, it began with a tweet where I shared a tweet of this guy, and then using Twitter started showing the process that I was going through to try to understand who he was. Well, he's got a hat? What's on that hat? He's got something on his belt. What's he got on his belt? What's that logo? It's Black Rifle Coffee Company. Well, that's interesting. That says something. What about, what was he doing before he got into the Capitol? Was he with anyone? Well, sure he was. Turns out he was walking with a woman. Became clear it was his mother. And so it was very much a process of looking for, at the time, needles in a haystack of needles, a crowd that nobody really understood, but that was massively captured in video and in picture by a lot of the participants. And so a lot of the work involved working from those images and that footage to try to understand what he'd been doing and who these people were.
So then John Scott Railton bought a picture of the man from what he calls a photo clearinghouse.
Just put up a couple $100 to buy the one-time rights to that picture so that I could tweet it one time and share it with people and have his face. Also the woman who he was with, and then find footage of him with her. And at one point, I think he refers to her as mom as he's walking there. And then walking back even further, there were people who thought that they had spotted him at a hotel. And then it turned out that journalist at Bloomberg, William Turton, had filmed some footage from the lobby of a particular hotel in D.C., and that footage caught the guy who was in a brief encounter. And all of these pieces came together ultimately to an identification that was fundamentally crowdsourced.
Now, when he says crowdsourced, John Scott Railton means the fact that citizen sleuths scoured all that footage that he just talked about. They found the photo of the man earlier in the day on January 6th standing next to a woman in a plaid shirt, his mother, as you heard. Then that led them to images at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Washington with the man's face uncovered. And that allowed the sleuths to crawl the internet and social media to find posts which ultimately identified the man as Eric Munchell of Nashville, Tennessee. Munchell currently faces multiple charges, including conspiracy to commit obstruction.
What was remarkable about the volunteer efforts that grew up is that they included people from around the U.S. and across the globe, all working for the same thing. And so to me, it wasn't just a conversation about a domestic issue. It was a conversation about what can we all do to try to stop this growing anti-democratic tide around the world.
The FBI had a huge, huge problem. It would have taken them a decade. If we didn't put all the evidence, all the footage on a silver platter for them. We're talking about, yeah, right now it's not that big anymore, but specifically in the beginning, we're talking about hundreds of people who are diving through thousands and thousands of hours of footage. The FBI doesn't have that manpower.
This is Mary. She lives in the Netherlands, and we are not using her last name because she fears for her safety and for her family's safety. Mary is Black, a grandmother, and active in the Black Lives Matter movement. She works as a citizen sleuth, and that work has put her in danger because for the last year, she spent her free time gathering information about January 6th. She provided information to investigative reporters like Ronan Farrow. And Mary says even though she hasn't given tips directly to the FBI, she knows the FBI has used her work. For example, she's seen photos she surfaced later turn up in court. Now, Mary helped identify former Oath Keeper Jessica Watkins, a trans woman who served in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2003. On January 6th, Watkins came to the Capitol in full tactical gear and celebrating inside. There's video of her celebrating inside as fellow Oath Keeper Donovan Crowell yells, we've took over the Capitol. We overran the Capitol. Well, last year, Watkins' attorney filed a motion for pretrial release, claiming that she was not violent on January 6th. She claimed her role was as, quote, a medic. But over in the Netherlands, Mary found footage on the internet showing Jessica Watkins doing much more than medical support.
And then I found a video of a group of Oath Keepers because they split up in when they were inside the Capitol. And this group was pushing against the police line in the corridor leading up to the old Senate chambers. And I saw Jessica and I heard her voice because it's also important, right, that you know how they sound, if it's possible. So I heard her shouting, like, let's get it in here, and they can't hold us, they can't stop us. Push, push, push. So she is literally instigating an entire mob, and you see her pushing, and she even grunts, and I was like, oh my God.
Mary sent that footage to New York Times reporter Christian Triebert, who then tweeted it out in a thread.
2 days later, the hearing was there. We see the court documents, and they literally linked to the threat. And they said Jessica Watkins is not going to be released, and she's still in jail.
Mary tells us she started paying close attention to the far right after the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, while she's not an American citizen, Mary says she still cares very deeply, especially as a Black woman.
For me personally, that had more impact because you're literally looking at Nazis marching in the streets in America, right? Yeah, the connection is there definitely with January 6th because we see a Confederate flag inside the Capitol building. And that's specifically that moment had like the same impact for me, right? Like, this is what white supremacy does. This is the face of institutionalized racism, the normalization of 4 years of Trump administration.
John Scott Railton has also been tracking far-right groups for years. And he says January 6th made efforts of citizen sleuths more urgent than ever.
January 6th happened, and I felt such powerlessness. What could I do but feel anger and frustration and fear and concern and worry and a million other things all at once? And then I did what I usually do when I feel really disempowered, which is I said, well, maybe I can investigate a little bit. Maybe I can figure out something. Maybe I can come to understand better.
Now, I want to be clear about something. I've been using the phrase citizen sleuths, and that is a distinctly positive name. You could also call them a Twitter mob, because there's always the risk of misidentification, either accidental or willful. So we asked John, what steps did he take to prevent that from happening?
And so one thing I did consistently was to say, remember, don't name people unless they've already been reported, and don't circulate names or speculations about names publicly, because there is such a risk. And I think what's interesting is how quickly the rest of the community also came to a similar conclusion.
Specifically, John told us he would not publicly name people, but instead give information first to journalists or federal investigators to validate that information. And then he would only tweet out the name after the person had been arrested or indicted or identified in the media. However, not everyone in the citizen sleuth community was as cautious. For example, Eric Munchel was identified and named online on January 8th, well before his arrest. But John Scott Railton says doing this work and doing it with tens of thousands of other people around the world gives him hope.
One of the challenges with January 6th was things were happening really fast, and there was so much that we didn't know. But it felt like a time when it was so important to act. And I just remember a quote from Mr. Rogers, and he's talking to his audience of kids, and I think he's speaking, I don't remember the details, but he's speaking to kids when they see something upsetting or troubling. And he says, look for the helpers. There will always be helpers. And I kept feeling that in the days after January 6th, when everything felt so unclear. Look for the helpers. And there they were. And that gave me, and I think a lot of other people, hope that not only were we not completely powerless in the face of an awful historic event, but that there was something that we could do together that might be really impactful.
John Scott Railton, he's at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. You also heard Mary in the Netherlands a little earlier. Ryan Riley, look, we've got a minute less than that now, but give us a sense as to how important the work of people on the internet was to lead to this moment with the sedition charges.
It's been really, really important in this overall investigation. Sometimes you'll see that come out very explicitly in a lot of these court documents. Sometimes it'll be a little bit under the radar, and then I'll find out afterwards that, oh yes, actually sedition hunters played a very big role in these cases. But it's really, truly amazing. I've seen both in real time how some of these IDs have unfolded, and I've seen cases where I'm wondering about someone and then they've long been ID'd months ago. And a lot of the response from these sedition hunters after these cases are actually brought to fruition is finally. That's how a lot of them feel, because they've known about who these individuals are for months.
Well, Ryan Riley, reporter with HuffPost, off to NBC News next month with us from Washington, D.C. today. Ryan, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Meghna, thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.